to describe what it is like to live through a war is, unless you've lived through it, is something that I think for a lot of people is really just very, very abstract. But it has been a very difficult now, nearly 7 months. In a few days' time, we will mark 17 months, not 7 months, 17 months since the atrocities of the 7th of October, where Hamas invaded parts of southern Israel, murdering over 1,200 people, committing rape, mutilating some of the victims, and taking over 250 people hostage. People of different religions, different countries, different races, they didn't care. They just came to cause as much carnage and destruction as possible. And we're a country very, very deep in grief. We are still mourning our murdered. We are still mourning the hostages that some who we received back in recent weeks who were murdered in captivity. And I don't think that we can honestly start to heal until we have all of our hostages back. I think that there is a very deep rupture in Israel, a very, very deep pain, and we absolutely acknowledge pain on the other side. I think that this has been an extremely brutal war for both sides. And right now, the Israeli people are deep in grief. But along with grief, we are extremely resilient. Two things can be true at the same time. You can be mourning, but you can also be an incredibly resilient people. And a people full of spirit. There is a deep love and care for each other in this country, despite the fact that we might have a million different opinions on so many different subjects. But if there's one thing that unites us, it's realizing that we are fighting for our survival. We are fighting in a world where anti-Semitism grows more and more every single day. And we're there for each other to help each other navigate this very, very difficult time.
Yes, and again, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the fact that you also acknowledge the pain on the other side. And obviously, now just take us one step further. Now that the ceasefire first phase has expired, what has transpired since then?
Well, it's a great question because we're kind of in no man's land at the moment. There are still negotiations underway. Israel wants to see an extension of phase one. Hamas say that they won't accept that. They want a total cessation of hostilities. However, Israel has to reach our military goals, and we have two main goals. First of all, the return of all of our hostages, living and deceased. And second of all, to ensure that Hamas is removed as a threat to both the people of Gaza and to the Israeli people. We cannot have another situation that creates a 7th of October ever again. And our defense minister, just a short while ago, threatened Hamas, return the hostages or else. We will open the gates of hell. And for all of this to end, Hamas is to do two very simple things: return all of our hostages, all 59 of them, and surrender. Accept that they have been defeated. Accept that it is not just Israel that wants a demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza Strip. It's many in the region as well. And let's start moving forward. However, at the moment, we are at a bit of an impasse. Israel is prepared to accept the proposal put forward by Steve Witkoff. He is the special envoy from the Trump administration, who says that let's have half of the hostages, both living and deceased, released immediately, and then the second half on a permanent ceasefire agreement. So now, let me tell you something. I don't know if I would want to be in the negotiating room.
Yes.
I think that if that is a very, very difficult place to be right now.
Right. Let me then ask you from this. If Israel demands the return of hostages, let's just say dead or alive, what is the concession that Israel is willing to put forward? Because if you rightly pointed out, the defense minister can threaten Hamas all they want. However, there are prisoners that are in jail in Israel. What is Israel saying about that?
Well, Israel has released an extraordinary amount of prisoners. And I have to be very, very clear that these are prisoners, many of them who are serving multiple life sentences for committing acts of terror against Israeli civilians. We've had the terrorists responsible for some of the worst atrocities being freed as part of the ceasefire deal. You know, in the Jewish religion, there is nothing more sacred than the redemption of the hostage, the redemption of the captive. So as painful as these concessions have been for Israel, for the Israeli public, we need to get our people back. And the past couple of weeks, as you so correctly said, have been very successful in getting hostages back. And some of those scenes have been extremely, extremely painful. We had the release of Eli Sharabi and Ohad Ben-Ami that were released absolutely emaciated, very, very thin, starved, tortured, taking us back to that horrific time in our history at the end of the Holocaust, where survivors resembled living skeletons. Mm. And then, of course, we had those very, very traumatic scenes where that I call the carnival of the grotesque in Gaza, when we had the first of the dead hostages released in coffins, the two little boys, Ariel Bibas and Kafir Bibas, who were murdered at the age of 4 and 10 months, respectively, and we now know from the autopsies, strangled by Hamas and other terror entities, along with their beautiful mother, Shiri, who the world saw being taken into Gaza, cradling her two babies, and an 83-year-old great-grandfather, Oded Lifshitz, who was a peacemaker. Oded used to drive children from Gaza to hospitals in Israel every week to get cancer treatment. You know, these are the type of people that were taken hostage and murdered on the 7th of October. And it was very, very traumatic to see the scenes of celebration and bringing young children to look at this parade of dead bodies in coffins in front of them. So it has been an extremely, extremely painful time. But from the perspective of the Israeli people, we know the situation for our hostages. They've been tortured, they've been chained, they're being starved. We've heard the accounts coming from hostages that are released, and we need all of our people back now.
Right. I think it's important that we take note of what you just said, that the parade, the UN actually criticized Hamas for that, and because they call it disrespectful. And if I believe correctly, that's when Netanyahu did not release the hostages last week, because he was very unhappy with that. Now, let's just go to the humanitarian question. Recently, as earlier today, Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, blamed Netanyahu for trying to topple the hostage deal, and then blaming it on Hamas. Remember, he withhold the aid, I think earlier today or yesterday. Why would Yair Lapid blame Netanyahu for trying to scupper the second phase of the ceasefire?
Well, I think there's two reasons. The first reason would be that there are opposition, and Yair Lapid has been a long-time critic of Netanyahu and the way that he has prosecuted this war, saying that he would have moved for a hostage deal a lot sooner. And the other reason, and it is a big concern to many of us, is that we heard from testimony coming from hostage Eli Sharabi, who was one of the three hostages that was released several weeks ago, that was very, very thin and came out of captivity to find out that his brother had been murdered in captivity, and that on the 7th of October, his wife and two daughters were murdered by Hamas, along with the family dog and along with having their house destroyed. And when he was speaking on Israeli TV, Eli said that every time somebody made a comment in the government, some of the more right-wing ministers made certain comments, or every time you know, they threatened to withhold aid, it was taken out on the hostages. They were denied more food, they were beaten more, they were tortured more. And so, you know, he said that Hamas would take out their anger on the hostages. So there's a lot of concern for that. But I also want to be very, very clear. Under international law, Israel is not obligated to provide humanitarian assistance. And I don't think we see in any war situation anywhere in the world where one party provides humanitarian aid to the enemy party while still prosecuting a war. So under Article 23 of the Geneva Convention, Israel's obligations are not to deter any third party aid, but we're not obligated to provide aid. Having said that, since just the 20th of January, 25,000 aid trucks have gone into the Gaza Strip. We have been very careful to ensure that there are 3,000 calories per person in the Gaza Strip. Naturally, none of them for the hostages, because Hamas has starved the hostages. So since the 7th of October and the start of this war, humanitarian aid has been going into the Gaza Strip regularly. In fact, I've been down to the border to the south many, many times, and I've seen that evidence for myself.
Yeah.
But the reality is we have a situation, and it has been acknowledged by other countries and the United Nations, that Hamas has taken that aid and either kept it for themselves or sold it to Palestinians at really ridiculous prices. And we have other incidents of aid not being collected from warehouses. So there are warehouses that do still have humanitarian aid. And from Netanyahu's perspective, he wants to put as much pressure on Hamas as possible now to, for them to release the hostages. Is this going to work? This is the question.
Right. Yeah, you are listening to Pushing Boundaries. We have Roland Marx out of Israel and telling us about the update on the current ceasefire impasse. And obviously, as you could hear, some of the hostages are back, and Israel has released some of the prisoners in return. And as you can hear, right now, there is a bit of a limbo in terms of what is going to happen next. But obviously, Roland, let me get back to you. So now that there hasn't been an agreement between the two sides, does that mean then that the Israel continues to bombard Gaza right now, or there has been a pause?
That's a great question, because right now there is no bombardments of Gaza unless there is an infringement of the ceasefire terms. That has been Israel's position. While we do have the army prepared and stationed on the border in case of any eventuality, the IDF has been very, very clear. Unless there have been violations of the current ceasefire or the phase one ceasefire agreement terms, there have been no attacks. We have had a few incidents where there have been opportunistic attacks, and the IDF have fired back accordingly. The same is the situation in the north. Mm-hmm. You know, what is very important for people to know is that on the 7th of October, Hamas may have attacked from the Gaza Strip, but from the 8th of October, Israel faced the beginning of war on multiple fronts, from Hezbollah in the north, from the Houthis in Yemen, that fired many times towards my own home here in the center of Israel. We had missiles fired from Iran. I can't forget those nights we sat in our shelters as missiles rained down on us from Iran. We had opportunistic terror groups from Syria, from Iraq firing at us, and we had terror attacks coming in from the West Bank. So it was Israel was essentially surrounded by a ring of fire. Now, at the moment, we've got the ceasefire holding in the north with Hezbollah. We've managed to push Hezbollah back. Everybody's aware of that very famous pager campaign.
That's right.
And now the situation with Hamas is, it's tense, but so far we are only responding to any infractions of the phase one ceasefire terms.
Fantastic. Before I let you go, one more question. What is the, how can I put it? What is Israel thinking of South Africa right now?
Well, that is a great question, because we know that the government of South Africa has taken a very, very hostile stance against Israel with this case at the ICJ, which is unbelievable that they managed to file that, I think, just 2 months into a war. And many of those accusations have been clearly debunked, including by the former president of the ICJ, who clarified their recommendations very clearly. What the South African government has forgotten is that very, very clear ruling from the ICJ that called for the immediate and unconditional release of the ceasefire of the hostages. Something that we haven't heard President Ramaphosa even mention once in these last now 17 months. But Israelis are very clear to separate between South African citizens and the South African government, because we have so many South Africans from all walks of life visiting our country, coming to see the reality on the ground for themselves. People like you who are talking to us to understand the situation that we are enduring. I mean, just being asked how we are, and I can speak for everyone in this country, means the world to us. So we're very clear that we separate between the government, which might be acting in the interests of other governments and other non-state actors, and not in the interests of South Africans and the South African people, who have been incredibly supportive and understand what happened on the 7th of October and have been supportive of Israelis. And it makes me very, very sad as somebody who grew up in South Africa to see South Africa's position, because our two countries face many of the same challenges, water issues, environmental issues, and Israel has the technologies to help South Africa, as we have many countries, including many countries across the African continent, deal with these challenges. And why should there be a suffering of the people of South Africa when we have solutions? The other point is, South Africa came through one of the most heinous periods in history through dialogue, through listening to both sides, through, you know, people from both sides trying to meet in the center and engage in conflict resolution. However, with South Africa taking such a hostile stance against the state of Israel for our defensive war against Hamas, and as you heard on many different fronts, South Africa has removed itself as an honest broker for any kind of peace in the future between Israel and the Palestinians, and that is the real pity.
Right. Here's the last question. How do you balance the need for security with the desire for peace and cooperation with the Palestinians?
Oh, that is such a brilliant question. I think that we had a very wise prime minister many years ago, Golda Meir. And Golda Meir spoke about the importance of loving your children more than you hate Israelis. And I think it all goes back to education and incitement of hatred. You know, when we saw the people of Gaza holding this carnival of hatred, when the bodies of four of our hostages were on a stage in front of them in coffins. I mean, I just found it absolutely ludicrous that you have countries accusing Israel of starvation when we could see for our own eyes, first of all, the people are not starving. Second of all, where does all the signage come from? Where does all the signage and the uniforms and the brand new cars and the state-of-the-art cameras and all of this come from? And every time there's a different hostage release, we see different signage, you know, it's all changed up. That costs a lot of money. Money that can go towards building a better future and providing a better future for Palestinians. So I think the way we balance it is that there needs to be a complete de-radicalization of the Palestinian people. No more incitement of hatred in schools, no more incitement of hatred in media. The reason why Israel has peace with so many of our Arab neighbors in our neighborhood is because they've taken out anti-Semitism from the textbooks, from the mosques, from the media, and made peace building a priority. The people who were murdered on the 7th of October in those kibbutzim along the border were the peace movement. The people like Oded Lifshitz, who drove Palestinian children to get their treatment for cancer in hospitals in Israel, and he was one of many. The young people who danced for peace on the border, hoping those on the other side would hear their message. Those were the people on the front line who paid the heaviest price. And that they paid the heaviest price because it came from incitement of hatred. That needs to be the first step. Once we start teaching peace and talking peace, then we'll start building peace. And peace isn't built through leaders. Peace is built from the ground up.
Right. Thank you very much. That was Rolin Marx out of Israel giving us an update on the current ceasefire. And we appreciate that message there from Mladelo, who said, how do we balance the need for security and the desire for peace and cooperation? Right. Rolin, thank you so much for joining us. And please do take care. And obviously, we will talk in the near future. But thank you for joining us. Right, yeah, let's go back to our show now, Pushing Boundaries with Kustas. We're going to take a break, and from here, we are going straight to the deputy of Defend Our Democracy, Dr. Rizokhofu Chikane, after this break.